Our reading from Luke's Gospel today comes from chapter 20, verses 9 to 19. Jesus went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one also they beat and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, "God forbid." Jesus looked directly at them and said, "Then what is the meaning that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone whom it falls will be crushed." The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately, because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people. Who here likes receiving presents? I guess most of you. It's great when someone gives you a gift. Expected or unexpected, it shows that they love and care about you. But what about giving presents to others? Who here likes giving presents? It's usually a bit more of a faff. You have to think about what someone might like, arrange to buy it or make it, then wrap it, and then give it to them. It might be a bit more of a faff, but I certainly enjoy giving people presents. So got one for you here that you can enjoy. Probably should have opened it first, but you can have it afterwards, but we'll get there. It's the thought that counts, they say, but our efforts at present giving may be heartfelt and at times extravagant, but they're nothing compared to the gift-giving nature of God. There is something fundamental about God that he is a gift giver. The story of the Bible, if it is about anything, it is a story of God's grace. And the word that is used in New Testament Greek for grace is the word charis. Now, this word charis that Paul in particular uses is not a technical term. It's not a special theological word, but it was a regular everyday word that was used to describe favours, gifts, and good turns that one could do for another. Grace was a gift that was offered. Charis was a gift you gave to someone else. And God is a gift giver, a grace giver, a charis giver. And I don't think God's nature as a gift giver is only restricted to the gift of salvation he offers us in grace. I think everything we have is a gift of grace from God. The world that we live in is a gift of grace from God, a world created in love and full of beauty. We could live in a world that was black and white. It wouldn't make any difference to how the world operated, really. But that was not how the world created the universe. God created the universe to be. We were created as well with the ability to see colour. Not all animals are created like that. We have a world bursting full of colour and vibrancy, and we can wander in that, and that can lead us into worship of the Creator. God also provides us with a world full of provision and abundance. And despite the inequality of distribution, we have a world that is able to support and provide habitation and resources for all of humanity. The world is an amazing self-sustaining biosphere, a gift from God that keeps on giving to us. Yet too rarely we acknowledge this and give thanks for this. The God who gives is the God whom we can experience and know day by day in our ongoing discipleship. God is not an absentee landlord who has set the world running like a clockwork toy, as some philosophers of times past have suggested, and then disappeared off to enjoy his rest. God is actively involved in the ongoing care and sustaining of the world as an enduring gift, not only for humanity, but for all he has created. The world has been gifted to humanity. But there's also an important biblical principle that reminds us that even though we have the earth to tend and steward, that the resources of the earth are here to sustain us and all living things, there is also a foundational truth found in some words from Psalm 24 that conditions all of this. Here it says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." This can be seen as kind of contrary to God gifting us the world for our good, but perhaps we can think of it like this. This church building we think of as ours. We are responsible for it, its upkeep, its the paying of the bills and the like. Yet we, in reality, don't own the building. The building is held in trust by the Baptist Union Corporation, so that future generations can benefit from this building. Future generations of believers, it will be passed on to them to care for. We, in essence, have been loaned this building as the present congregation to use for God's glory. And we have been gifted this world and all its resources by God, yet its ownership is still held in trust by God. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. The world is still God's, yet God has given it to us to care for and steward as a long-term loan. And this foundational truth should impact how we view all that we have and how we use what we have. We tend to centre our view of the universe upon ourselves, but Psalm 24 verse 1 is a wake-up call to us that says, no, you are not the centre of the universe. God is. The verse points towards the truth that everything, and that means everything, in the end belongs to God. As human beings, we tend to think that our wants and desires have the highest authority, that we are the ones that own every resource in the world. Like colonial explorers, we plant our flag and say that is ours. The Bible, however, paints a different picture, and that picture shows that everything is God's. Land, sea, sky, iron ore, trees, wheat, iPhones, Converse All-Stars, and all our money. All of it is God's. And if we truly understand that everything is already God's, that means that nothing is actually ours, and everything in reality is actually only on loan to us to use wisely and for God's glory. And it's perhaps one of the most humbling lessons that the Bible can teach us, especially in our consumerist culture, in our affluent Western world. Because we are so used to thinking we own this or that. We have our money, our house, our possessions. But the Bible reveals a view that actually says everything's God's. Our money is only in our care. It doesn't belong to us. We only have it on loan from God, even though it's on a loan that is at a very favourable rate. We have a responsibility in how we react in relation to the gift that we've been given by God. It's a responsibility, and it's a responsibility that is shared in some of the first words spoken about humanity in the Bible. Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and every living creature that moves on the ground. What does it mean for humanity to subdue and rule? Well, that's clarified in the parallel accounts in Genesis 2, chapter verse 15. The Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work and to take care of it. That's what it means to rule and to subdue, to work and to take care of. And humanity, the word for man in human Hebrew, is Adam. And Adam is the representative figure for all of humanity. Humanity is gifted the responsibility for tending and caring for planet Earth. And this is our role of stewardship. And not even our rebellion has changed that, even though our stewardship has often become selfish rather than done for the benefit of all creation and for the glory of God. But we come back to the God who gives. Is God really the one who continues to give? Our reading from Luke's Gospel can seem a bit strange in terms of what we are thinking about. But the parable of the tenants reminds us of the persistent goodness and grace of God, even in the face of humanity's efforts to reject him. The vineyard in the parable is an image that represents Israel. And Jesus uses this image because of some words spoken in Isaiah. I will sing of the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest of vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a winepress as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could you have done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'll take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, it will be trampled. I will make it into a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but he heard cries of distress. The vineyard in the parable is, as in Isaiah's prophecy, the land of Israel. The man who planted the vineyard in both the parable and the prophecy is God. The tenant farmers in the parable are God's people, Israel. And in the parable, servants are sent to these farmers to collect the harvest. And in the parable, they represent the prophets that God continually sent to Israel to give them warning after warning. And the servants were rejected, they were killed, they were abused, just as God's prophets were. But God kept acting in grace until one day, God, like the landowner in the parable, sent his son. Surely his son, the one who will one day inherit the vineyard, will be respected. But no, the tenants see the son and think, if they kill him, then the vineyard will be ours. So that's what they do. They kill the son and claim his inheritance. We can look at the parable and see all the negatives, see what those tenant farmers did, but turn it around and look and see what the owner did. He did what he probably shouldn't have done. From the time the first servant was rejected and killed, he could have sent in the troops and committed violence, but he doesn't. He tries again and again to do something good until he sends his son. And that's the way of God. He continues to pour out his grace, even when that grace is rejected, ignored, and misunderstood. And at the end of the parable, God doesn't tear down the vineyard in a fury. Now, his tenants are dispensed with, but new tenants are found. Grace is extended to others, from Jew to Gentile, from Israel to the whole world. It is in the very nature of God to give of himself and to keep on doing so. We have a giving God, and I'd like to suggest that his giving nature is summed up in four words. The first word is faithfulness. God's provision and gifts to humanity have never failed. Paul, while preaching in Lystra, says this: he has shown his kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. Year after year, the faithfulness of God is seen in the land yielding its harvest. The faithfulness of God is seen in his promises never failing. God has continued to provide for his people. The second and third words are abundance and generosity. I don't know what you ate for dinner yesterday, but it probably wasn't the same as you had the day before, or the day before that. There's a huge variety of food that can sustain us. God miraculously provided Israel in the desert with manna and quail for 40 years. I would have probably got fed up with that after the first week, but knowing there was nothing else, I would have probably kept on eating it anyway. We live in an affluent part of the world where we can experience the abundance of God's provision easily. But many in the world experience an unequal sharing of resources. Many in the world will survive on meagre or limited diets. And that's not what God desires. God's desire is perhaps better seen in the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, where all eat their fill and there is an abundance of leftovers. God's desire is seen in the promise of the great feast to come at the end of history, where there is the best food and wine for everyone. God provides, but it's humanity that withholds. God gives generously and abundantly. And the fourth word is sacrifice. God gives sacrificially, because we always remember that supreme example of God's giving. And that is seen in the coming of Jesus, where God humbled himself in becoming human, sacrificing his divinity in order to take on human form and lived as one of us to die for all of us. God knows the sacrifice of giving. Not in the sense that it costs him financially, but he knows what real sacrifice is about. He knows that sacrifice is about costing you what is most important to you. At the beginning, I spoke about the word charis, meaning the giving of a favour or a gift or a good turn. But it could also be used by people in the first century to describe their response to being given a gift. Charis could also mean thank you. Charis, grace, then ended up being a cycle of grace. You gave a gift, you said thank you, you responded. The gift-giving God gives, and he doesn't expect or demand a response on our part. But as we come to know and come into a relationship with the gift-giving God, we will in turn become people who ourselves become like the gift-giving God. in our nature. We will respond in giving thanks, in giving with grace of our time, our resources, our lives to others, back to God. And this is something we're going to further explore over the next few weeks. How we care for what we've been given, how we give back to God, and how we give thanks to a generous God. Let's pray. God of freely given grace, may we become a people who give of grace in all of our lives. Amen.